nation in a very serious economic crisis. We've spent for decades far more than we take in or ever could take in revenue. We have simply increased our credit limit and continued to spend for decades. No problem. Just expand the debt limit and continue spending. Don't you wish you could do that? Well, this is catching up to Europe as well. They're in the same trouble that we are, particularly Greece, Spain, and now Italy, have overspent, and there is no money over there to bail them out. And President Sarkozy had meetings yesterday with President, whatever her title is, Merkel of Germany. What do we do? What do we do? Well, things are not looking very good, and as I mentioned here when I was talking in the announcements, a lot of this goes, you can go back decades. And the Church of God is part of the end-time prophecies and warnings of things to come. We wrote about it in the Plain Truth and, I believe, in the Good News. And we certainly spoke about it on radio and television over the years, that these things were going to happen and would lead into something very ominous in the time of the end. Well, what is the meaning of this crisis that we see taking place in the U.S. and around the world? Where is it headed? What may it lead to in the near future? And does the Bible shed any light on what we are witnessing and what we are seeing? Well, today I want to look at what God teaches about economics, the laws and principles, and then secondly, how economics will have a significant role in end-time prophecy. I'd like to begin by first looking at what God taught Israel concerning economic principles and laws. To do that, I want to go back to the time of Abraham to point out something about what God had planned for Israel through Abraham, starting with him. You recall that in Genesis 12 and in verse 2, it says, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. This is what the descendants of Abraham, and particularly the one that later would be changed from Jacob to Israel, would have. In these end times, the church believes that this has been fulfilled and that we are living in the fulfillment of that in the times that we now presently live. The United States is the single greatest nation that has ever existed. This is no accident, nor has it come about by time and chance, as maybe some would think. No, there was prophecy being fulfilled. There was a design from the very beginning, more than 3,000 years ago. I would like to go to Deuteronomy 28. At the end of the 40 years, Moses was inspired to write what we commonly call the blessings and the cursings that God would give to Israel if Israel would obey him. And what would be taken away if Israel would not obey him? And it's quite interesting. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I want to center on one that has to do with economics. First of all, in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 1 and 2, now it shall come to pass that if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. And then he proceeds to list all the blessings that they would have. Now look at verse 12. The Lord will open to you the good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain to in your land in its season, which, by the way, I think we all know is missing. This is the season, and the seasons have gone by out in the southern and western states. And to bless all the work of your hand. Now notice, you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. Well, what has happened when we look at these things today? We are not a lending nation. We're a borrowing nation today. We have been for quite some time. Other nations, of course, are looking at our credit rating as to whether to buy our bonds, which means that they're loaning to us by buying those bonds because they expect that they're going to get back with interest at some point down the road. Are we still a good investment is what other nations are looking at. The Chinese practically own us. The Japanese are heavily into us as well. We should be the lender and the helper, shouldn't we? Obviously, Israel was to become a great nation because he said, if you obey me, I'm going to make you great so that you will lend to a nation, you will lend to many nations. And you won't be borrowing, but you will be lending. That means you're going to be prosperous. You've got to have something to lend. This is one of the things I think is interesting to see, that he was going to, from the beginning, to build them to become a great nation at one point in time. And they should be the lenders, not the ones who are borrowing. Now you may say, well, yes, we do lend to other nations, but we have to borrow to cover our lending and spending. you can point to nations where we've lended to, but where'd we get the money to lend? Well, it had to come from, because it all comes from the same pot, so to speak, and we take more out than is put in, do we not? Now let's drop down and take a look at verses 43 through 48 of the same chapter here. In verse 43, the alien who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. Why? Because he's going to prosper more. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. And he shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. Now, if you turn away from me and you don't obey me any longer, this, among many other things here in the latter part of this chapter, is what's going to happen. Verse 45, moreover, all these curses shall come upon you and pursue and overtake you until you are destroyed, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded you. And they shall be upon you for a sign and a wonder, and on your descendants forever, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and gladness of heart for the abundance of everything. Therefore you shall serve your enemies, whom the Lord will send against you in hunger and thirst and nakedness and in need of everything, and he will put a yoke of iron on your neck until he has destroyed you. Well, that certainly did happen once to Israel. It happened also once to Judah. But most like all prophecy, there is dualism in it, and we may be living to see it happen again in our time. Now, this is where we find ourselves today when we look at these verses 43 through 48 in terms of economics. We are not being blessed. You might say, well, we're doing it to ourselves. And yes, we certainly are. But we're certainly not following the laws of God either. If you turn back here to Deuteronomy 15, and once again we'll see what God was expecting for Israel, promising for Israel, in chapter 15, verse 5 and 6. Only if you carefully obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe with care all these commandments which I command you today. For the Lord your God will bless you just as he promised you. You shall lend to many nations, but shall not borrow. And you shall reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over you. Quite interesting. I mean, we're talking about our time, too. When you read, like Mr. Kylo says in his letter, read Deuteronomy 28. Of course, this is repeated in Deuteronomy 28. And what do you see? It's like reading the paper here this morning almost, or for the last quite a number of decades of years. But that it doesn't end right here in Deuteronomy chapter 15, because if you drop down to verse 7, we begin to see some of the problems here of what happens where the blessings begin to disappear. If there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. But you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend to him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Now, it's interesting, not just to pour out and just give, but to lend. And there is a reason for lending, because the individual is to be helped so he can, or she, whatever the case, to be able to get onto their feet and not just continually be always giving, 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 because they then begin to accept that as though that's the way it always should be. But now look at verse 9 and through 11. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying that the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and it becomes sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works, and in all to which you put your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, that you shall open your hand wide to your brother and to your poor and your needy in your hand land. You will prosper one day as a nation if you obey me, and you will lend to many nations, and you will reign over many nations, we just read. Still, there will be a certain element or percentage of those who are poor in your midst, and you are always to help them, and help them to help themselves. You find this throughout the Bible here, and that means something to God, because he said to them, you once were slaves in Egypt, and really no mercy was shown. And the mercy, of course, is when God finally then heard the prayers and cries and brought them out. We most of our foreign aid has been to buy, that we give here, that we've tried to help other nations, has been to buy allies. And unfortunately, many of them turn to hate us for it. We haven't really given and helped really so much so they could help themselves. A lot of times it was simply to see if we could win them over to our side in the Cold War and battle against communism. We were, of course, to lend to the poor, as it's said here, and not attach burdensome strings to make money off of the poor. Many times that's happened. Many people today who should never have gotten into buying homes, but, of course, they were lured into it. Easy payments, you know, a lot of times not only in homes but other things, and they have lost them. Strings were attached. And when things didn't go well, they could not keep up with it. Those who have a certain responsibility God gives to those. And when you're helping others who are in need of help, you do not put them in a situation where they literally become a slave to you because they can't make payment back. That's been a test in history, a trial for people all through the ages. The feudal system in Europe, for example, and how people came from Europe over here on ships. They had to work as indentured servants for years. I think it was 7 years, if I remember right, in the colonial period of time, to pay back coming over here on the ship, whatever. And, of course, the ship was coming over here to pick up goods to go back and make money anyhow. But then these people would, who had nothing and were trying just simply to escape the England and Europe for religious reasons, usually, and because of the intolerance that was there. But they were, for a long time, left as slaves and impoverished and poor. So why are we failing economically as a nation and have become a borrower? More than just what I just read here, there are other reasons as well. Let's take a look here in Deuteronomy chapter 23. Because when we see the principles, and these are laws that God gave, I guess you would call it part of the law of Moses. It's an extension of the Ten Commandments. This is how you're to treat your fellow man, your fellow citizen in Israel. Here in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 19 and 20. Verse 19, you shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest. To a foreigner you may charge interest, but to your brother you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all to which you set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. Well, your brother was your citizen in Israel at that particular time. What about today? When you look at the situation with interest, it's incredible what people have to pay. God said that you're not to charge them the interest. You know, there's a lot about usury or interest in the Bible, and particularly in the Old Testament. Also, we'll see a little bit in the New Testament as well. We live in a society we're so interested. We are so used to paying interest that we just finally, we don't think any more about it. But the high interest rates that you find in whatever area of purchase that you would want to make, that is not. God considers that almost as extortion. And we will see. By the way, another thing you might want to look up, take your concordance, look up usury, and also look up extortion. Because many of these things that we take today, though they are legal by our laws, are considered really as extortion by God and taking from people. In Exodus 22 and verse 25 is where the law was first given about usury. Exodus 22 and in verse 25. If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest. Now, there were money lenders, creditors. You find the word creditors, too, by the way, in the Bible. But when it came to your fellow citizen and those particularly who were poor and in need and help, you don't take advantage of them. Yes, you lend and you help them, but you have no strings tied to it. Notice again here in Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25. This is not the only reason, economically speaking, why we are not blessed. It is one. High interest rates are a good way to, well, they lead to what? Inflation. And a number of things that can really cripple an economy as time goes by, as well as impoverish those who are involved having to pay it. In Leviticus 25 and in verse 35 through 37, in verse 35, if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. You're to help him out. If you have, you're to do this. Now, I know it's been said that the United States has done more to help nations that have had catastrophes and problems, and that's true, than any other nation. The United States has given much, much more. I think God certainly has recognized that when what happened in Haiti over a year and a half ago. Who's the one that brought in the most aid? I don't care where it has been. It's always been the United States that has done that. A lot of times, though, we have, in helping other countries, maybe haven't always done it to, we did it to buy friends and allies, and instead is all it did is they despised us even more in a lot of cases, and we looked like we were kind of silly in what we were doing. This is one of the things that God wants, but what about the people inside the United States, the citizens of this country? We've done a lot to help people outside. Yes, we have sent food and shipments by plane and huge cargo planes and everything to try to help those in areas of disaster, which is good. But we have a lot of people now who are a disaster right now, are into a disaster with the unemployment situation, with the foreclosures and housing, and the people both out of work and out of homes in many, many cases. A lot of things that the government has done or allowed to be done has resulted in that. It should not have happened. And many people, not knowing any better, got involved in some of these things thinking, oh, this is wonderful. And then it all caught up. We certainly do have extremely high interest rates, and some of which the Bible would even refer to as extortion. In Ezekiel chapter 22, Ezekiel 22, and this, of course, is the time of the captivity, and he talks about this. Now, the word extortion is an English word. It's translating a Hebrew word, and as we'll see in the New Testament, a Greek word. So we want to look at, well, what are the meanings that the translators used here to explain the word. In Ezekiel 22, if I can get there, I'll read it, and in verse 12. In you they take bribes to shed blood. You take usury and increase. You have made profit from your neighbors by extortion and have forgotten me, says the Lord God. So you take interest and usury, you increase on that with your neighbor, and you have profited from your neighbors by extortion. The Hebrew word there I'm not going to spell it. I'm not going to pronounce it because I can do neither at this point in time, but I did look it up. It means by fraud, unjust gain or extortion. And because when you charge between 20 and 36% interest on credit cards or on loans or whatever it might be, God looks at that as almost as an extortion. It is outrageous to think, and we seem to get used to it as time goes by. When you look at the mortgages that people have gotten themselves into, the adjustable mortgage rates for, what is it, up to 3 to 5 years, whatever they run, all interest, no principal. Now, hey, we want to help you out. Easy terms. You go in, you buy a car. What can you pay per month? We can do 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. 6 years will really get you down here. I tell you, they really love to have you come in. Of course, now if something, a couple years goes by and this car is not going to work out, we need to trade it in. Or we need to try to sell it. Well, you haven't paid enough principal down if you have one of those long-term loans. In order, you're upside down there. Of course, I'm upside down in my home. We had a great deal when we bought it. Then the bottom went out in Lee County. And so the value has gone down. We'd have to come up with probably $10,000-$15,000 to just break even. And in that situation, there's nothing we can do about it. That's just the way it is. And hopefully, as time goes by, things will begin to turn around. The foreclosures bought up, and gradually things will begin to return so that at least we can break even without having to borrow something if we had to sell to break even. But you can see, when you look at some of these interest rates that are charged and are given, they are not a good deal. And we're not going to see this in the world tomorrow. In the New Testament, let's take a look. Luke chapter 18. Luke 18, you're very familiar with this parable here. In Luke 18 and in verse 1, then he spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not lose heart. saying there was a certain city. Well, I've got it mixed. It doesn't look right. The word extortion is used. Why did I get the wrong verse down there? I do that every time. Not every time, but... Well, anyhow, I put the wrong one down there. It's the parable, really, of the... I'll tell you what it is. And if you spot it real quickly, let me know. Parable of the publican and the Pharisee. And he came to the temple, and the Pharisee said, I'm glad I'm not like this publican, an extortioner. The word, the Greek word used there in the next scripture I'm going to turn to, which I do know I have correct, is in 1 Corinthians 5. It's the same word. It means ravenous. What one? Okay, verse 11. I did have it. I should see, I had 18:1. I didn't put 18:11 down. I had half of it there. The Pharisee stood and he prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, ravenous. What it means, it's ravenous for gain. That's what they literally is talking about in the Greek. And the English translators use the word extortion as the best word they could come up with to cover that that expression. And then I'm verse 11. And extortioners, unjust adulterers, or even as this tax collector. Now, Matthew was a tax collector at one time. And I'm sure the Jews thought he was an extortioner. Of course, you know, there's a flip side on that. A lot of times the tax collector was extorting money to put in his own pocket as well as give to the Romans. But the other side is that any time you're given a tax bill, it's extortion as far as the one who has to pay it. What kind of a tax collector Matthew was before he was converted, well, we just don't know. But they did not have a good reputation, did they? If you notice, Paul speaks of this in 1 Corinthians 5. in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10 and 11. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. let me back up. I'm in 2 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 10 and 11. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous or extortioners. Again, the same word is in Luke chapter 18, or idolaters, since you would need to go out of the world. But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard, or an extortioner, who is out trying to get money off of people and off brethren, not even to eat with such a person. A lot of times we look at these other things, sexually immoral, sure, we understand that. Covetous, of course, a person who is an extortioner is a covetous individual in that regard. Or an idolater, or a drunkard. Yeah, that makes sense. An extortioner? Stop and think and look up the word the Greek word here for that's being translated as extortion. Paul was a former Pharisee. He understood the laws of the Old Testament, the laws of Moses. He understood about usury. He understood about extortion as the prophets talked about it. And that was as big of a sin as well, to try to take advantage of people and get money off of them in a way that they should not. Now, one other thing on this before we move on to another reason why we are a borrowing people today and why we are not really blessed as a nation. And over here in Nehemiah in the Old Testament, this is interesting. Nehemiah and chapter 5, coming back from the captivity. And of course, Nehemiah was not one of the originals to come back. He and Ezra came back much later. Actually, what was it? Probably about 70 years later before they came back. But Nehemiah chapter 5 and verse 7. He said, after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said to them, each of you is exacting usury or interest from his brother. So I called a great assembly against them. We need to call. This is serious matter. That's how he looked at it. Drop down verse 10 and 11. I also, with my brethren and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please, let us stop this usury, this interest charging on these things. Restore now to them even this day their land, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, into also a hundredth of the money. That's 1% of the grain and the new wine and the oil that you have charged them. 1% was high interest. Wouldn't you love to have that kind of interest on anything? 1%. And that was a sin, be charging that. And notice what happened here as a result. They were losing their land. There was foreclosure on land and vineyards, their olive groves. They couldn't make the payments. They could not pay whatever principal they owed back, or whatever steps of principal payments were to be made, plus 1%. And how that 1% was being figured, it could be more than one way, so that the money certainly would have been accruing, or the interest certainly would have done that. Well, just for your information there to see, that is how God looked at it. In the world tomorrow, is he going to be charging people huge interest rates on their homes? You know, a 30-year mortgage, and you remember seeing those papers you signed, and if you take 30 years to pay for that house, how much you will have paid the bank? Boy, it's incredible. Well, you try to get less years so you can just save on interest, do you not, and get it paid for, and get it. If you can get a 15-year loan, how much better off you are. Compare what it would be if you go over the 15 years as opposed to 30 years, how much interest you've paid, one versus the other. All right, the usury business is not something that God is going to bless us for as a nation. We find ourselves as a borrowing nation today. What other reasons do we have for being a borrowing nation? Let's go to Amos chapter 8. Amos chapter 8. And here we see in the Minor Prophets a very interesting prophecy against Israel of that day, and yet it is very much apropos down through generations and certainly to us today. In the 8th chapter of the book of Amos, and verse 5 and 6, saying, "When will the new moon be passed?" Israel says this, "and that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath, when will it be over with, that we may trade wheat?" Now notice the rest of it. "Making the ephah small and the shekel large, falsifying the scales by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, even sell the bad wheat." Now, what is all this talking about? First of all, the ephah there in the second half of verse 5 was a dry measure of grain that equaled about two-thirds of a bushel today. Now, if you reduce the ephah, as it says, let's say to a half a bushel size, but you sell it for the same price as a two-thirds bushel as it was before, what do you have? Inflation, right? Now, the shekel is the silver shekel that is mentioned here, and it mentions in verse 6. Also, you'll find that it's described in Leviticus 5 and in verse 15, but I'm not going to turn there to it. It was coinage. It was the coinage, a standard coinage that the Hebrews used. And it was always, in most all cases, silver. There was a gold shekel, but it was very rare. The one that was the common one was the silver shekel. If you increase the weight of the shekel, which says you increase it, what do you do? Well, you cheat the person, you rob the person, and you create again inflation by doing that. Very interesting how it's talking about inflation. Do we have inflation? As I told you earlier, going back 45 years ago, I didn't think about this at the time I gave that sermon. I think it was at the beginning of last month. Might be good to go back and think about it. What were goods and services, what did they cost in 1966 compared to today for the same thing? Inflation is killing us. Killing us. Of course, everything has to go up. Wages have to go up to pay for all the goods and services that go up. And why are they all going up? Why aren't they, if anything, going down so that you, in other words, you cannot buy with the money you made, you couldn't buy it back, the money you made back in the 60s, the things that you buy today, the same things today. There was an interesting piece on TV yesterday. I happened to walk through the house there when we had Fox News on, and they did a piece on this man in New York who's moving his hotel and staff from New York to Dallas, Texas. Some of you may have seen it. Very interesting, and he being interviewed. It is so, the inflation is so high in New York, the cost of living is so great, that he said, and they showed pictures of his place in New York and the new one being constructed, renovated. Actually, it's an old place he's renovating into a beautiful hotel in Dallas, Texas. Why is he doing it? Because I can take my staff and go to Dallas and pay them less money, and they will live better on less money in Dallas than they would on more money in New York. You know, they pointed out also, I believe it's 1.6 or 7 million people have moved out of New York in the last 10 years for that very reason. And businesses, of course, are looking elsewhere and going other places to live because of extreme inflation and taxation and all of that. Now, this is not the only place in the prophets, and you might notice here in Micah chapter 6 where it talks about, again, the sin of inflation. And we certainly know it today, the government and the system that we live under has really not done a whole lot to bring it down. It's not just the cost of oil, but a lot of things that we and the decisions we make, we spend too much money, and we don't take in. I heard here the other day that we take in about $1 trillion in revenue every year, but we spend $2 trillion. Now, how can you, there comes a point you cannot raise debt limits forever. There comes a point when you're, I can't imagine what $1 trillion is. Can you imagine that? $1 trillion. It used to be billions, and we used to think, I can't imagine how many, billions of dollars. These are just giant numbers with endless zeros after them, that the interest, you ever see that on the news where they show the daily interest, the interest clock ticking away up there on $14 trillion debt going on and on? And absolutely incredible. In Micah chapter 6, verse 10 and 11, we have the same thing here. Are there yet the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked, and the short measure of the ephah, that is an abomination? Shortchanging by the ephah, by the measuring of the grains. And shall I count pure those with the wicked scales and with the bag of deceitful weights for the shekel? Because it was on the silver standard there that they used. And, of course, by what they were doing, causing inflation in the country. What else? We have inflation. We have deliberate inflation being set up here and going on in this country. Another reason. Let's go to 1 Kings 12. High interest rates, inflation, and Solomon made a mistake. I don't think people are, they know that he had 1,000 women, but this is something else. That didn't help either. But 1 Kings chapter 12, and in verse 4, 1 Kings 12, 4. They came after Solomon died to Rehoboam, and they said, "Your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you." Well, you know what happened. He listened to the wrong advisors. And so, as a result, the nation split. What was the heavy yoke Solomon was putting on the people that, in a lot of cases, I don't think people realize what it was? If you go back to chapter 5, let's go back to chapter 5 and 13 through 15, verse 13. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel, and the labor force was 30,000 men. He sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They were 1 month in Lebanon, 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the labor force. Solomon had 70,000 who carried burdens and 80,000 who quarried stone in the mountains. Why did they do that? People think of building the temple that the stone was just to cut to build the temple. No, first of all, you got to build the platform for the temple to sit on. Because Mount Moriah is like any other mountain. It goes up like this and goes down like that. So you had to build a level platform. It's called the Temple Mount. The stones are incredible. And underneath, because as you go out to the south, you got to build it up higher. If you go to the north, I don't think you have to go quite as high to whatever it is to level. But I have not been there underneath, but I have been on the outside. I have seen pictures of some of the in books on the inside, underneath. And there are huge cavities of open space with, in fact, you had stables on one end of it. And and you have these huge pillars holding everything up. Now, once you build the platform, then you can build the temple on top of the platform. But you've got to have something level up there, and it's on stone, solid stone, huge stone. It came out of Lebanon, according to what we read here. So what was it that Solomon was the mistake? It was heavy taxes and conscripted labor that was killing the people. They weren't just paying their tithes. Beyond this, the people all had, not only those who had labored, who were conscripted to go up there and to work a month up and 2 months back in shifts, but they also had to pay taxes. How do you think all of that was paid for? Now, during the Depression of the 1930s, President Roosevelt in the New Deal had all of the government work programs to put all the people back to work, and they were paid small wages and so forth. Hundreds, thousands were put to work in these camps and so forth around the country. Who paid for it? You have to have a private sector that is producing wealth, paying taxes to the government in turn to pay the labor to do that. The government does not produce wealth. It takes it in, and from those who do. And, of course, the same thing was true right here. Solomon had these people, the citizens of Israel at that time. It was a very expensive project. Now, it wasn't just the temple. He had his fortified cities at Hazor, Megiddo, and Lachish. He built these up, fantastic cities. And stables were his chariots, where everything was set up, especially at Megiddo. And it took a lot of money, a lot of resources. That meant, where does that come from? It comes from all of you who want to, you know, pay your fair share. And another problem that leads to borrowing is heavy taxation. Taxation because you're spending more than you're taking in. And we certainly have that today. In fact, I read a book about this, in which included Solomon. You know, that was one of the problems with the building of the pyramids, is the heavy taxation and what it took out of the people to build the pyramids. And it wasn't just all slave labor, because you had many resources that went into that. Let's move on here. Let me check real quickly. Yes, move on quickly. Taxation, something else that is also a real factor in causing us to be the borrowing nation today that we are. And the Europeans share in this with us, and that is socialism. Socialism. I'd like to read a little bit here about socialism. I'm not going to spend much time on it. There are different kinds of socialism, and many times what you find is a mix between socialism and capitalism in a lot of countries. If you get too much socialism and too little capitalism, you are in trouble. You are in trouble. Let me give you some of the basic types of socialism that are prevalent anymore in the world and have been in history. If I get my notes here, I missed one page. I'll be with you in just a minute, and there it is. Socialism can be traced all the way back to Plato in 360 B.C., probably one of the places where you will find it in, let's call it, coming since the time of Christ would be in 1515 in England, Thomas More, when he came up with his book entitled Utopia. Utopia was where everybody is equal. Now, you can see why that people were dreaming and thinking and philosophizing in that period of time, because of the burdens that people had living under feudal systems and England at that time. So his philosophy was that all people in a society would become all equal and all share in everything. The biggest modern socialism can be traced back to the French Revolution in 1789. I forgot the French philosopher who was really behind it, but where the state would confiscate and own all of the land, and the people would be farming for the state, and they would all share equally. There have been quite a number of different types of socialism over the years. Guild socialism, which was based in early 19th century England. Workers' guilds, similar to unions today, were responsible for control and management of goods. Utopian socialism, it advocates the social ownership of industry and a voluntary, nonviolent surrender of property to the state. That has also been something that has existed. We have had, and you may not realize it, socialist societies in the United States. Tennessee, Indiana, out in Oregon, and they still exist, where people come to live in what we probably would call like a commune system, where they all share together, and their labor and their profits from their labor are all put together, and they all then receive equally, no matter whether one has done more than the other. You have state socialism. It allows major industries, in this case, to be publicly owned and operated, but controlled over by the state. Christian socialism. There are, yes, Christian socialists. It first developed in England in 1848. It was born from the conflict between competitive industry and Christian principles. Christian socialist societies are led by various religious leaders. Anarchism Anarchism, you hear the term and you think it's just everybody wants to destroy, but no, it is a type of socialism behind anarchism. It opposes domination by the family, the state, the religious leaders, and the wealthy. It is opposed to any form of repression and has been associated with radical events and assassinations. President William McKinley was assassinated by an anarchist who also was an extreme socialist. Market socialism. This is often referred to as a compromise between socialism and capitalism. The government still owns many of the resources, but market forces determine production and demand. Communism. It's a militant type of socialism that advocates equal labor and equal shares of the benefits derived from labor. For example, Fidel Castro has always said he's a socialist. Well, that's right, but he's also a communist, and then communism is a much more militant form of socialism. That's kind of interesting as far as the history of it and behind it from Marx and Engels, their writings on communism. Now, let me just give you a few things, the differences here, before then I'll move on. Between capitalism and socialism, capitalism means of production and distribution of goods are owned by individuals and corporations. Under socialism, the means of production are owned by the government or the state. And this was one of the things when the government took over the auto industry here in United Auto Workers. You heard people talking about becoming socialist, government owning one of the largest corporations in the world. Another thing, capitalism, it features a class-based society. Socialism rejects the necessity of a class-based society in favor of a society of all equals. Is that really real? That everybody, that you have a society of millions of people and everybody will be exactly economically equal? Capitalism fosters a competitive atmosphere in which workers and companies are encouraged to work hard to achieve personal success. Socialism encourages an atmosphere of cooperation in which no matter how hard a person works, he or she reaps the same benefits as everyone else. How is that in terms of morale? If you work hard, if you produce, because do we all have the same talents and the same abilities? And what if you are a high achiever, but you have to take what you achieve and it's all be given to those who either do not work, do not care, or simply don't have the same abilities? Capitalism fosters a, capitalism fosters a competitive atmosphere in which workers and companies are encouraged to work hard to achieve personal success. Socialism, on the other hand, encourages an atmosphere of cooperation which no matter how, I did read that, I'm sorry, he or she reaps the same benefits as everyone else. Now, capitalism, ownership of private property is encouraged. I want you to think about some of this, these things I'm reading. What will Jesus Christ do? What did we learn in the Old Testament on private property? Okay. Ownership of private property is encouraged under capitalism. Under socialism, ownership of private property is largely forbidden under pure socialism because everyone shares it all. Under capitalism, it produces goods based on the law of supply and demand. Under socialism, government mandates production and prices. Planned economy under socialism. Now, what we've had here really since probably the new era, the New Deal period of time is mixed economy, a mixed economy. It's an economy that utilizes some capitalist and some socialist principles. The government usually controls some aspects, but private individuals and corporations control other aspects. A mixed economy relies on the law of supply and demand to determine production and prices. That's why when President Reagan came into office, he said, get the government off business's backs. so they can produce. When the government is over the business, there's too much regulation. And as a result, these things begin to take place. All right, let me get back to my other notes here. There's it's interesting when you look at some of the various things about socialism and its tenets. It is one of the main problems that we find here today. You cannot spend and have government take control of everything. It is because, first of all, you don't have enough money coming in from the private sector, and that's the only place they're going to get their money. Either other countries are going to give it to us by buying our bonds, or we're going to take it in by taxation. So the government produces no wealth. It confiscates wealth in the form of taxation and then redistributes these things. And this can be a real problem. Obviously, that will lead to inflation. Now, let me come back here to some of these notes. Socialism gets into the redistribution of wealth by taxation and government takeover over of industry, resources, and land. It will vary from one nation to the other. They practice it as to what degree they get into taking over industry, resources, and even the land. That's what you have in communism. That's what you have in Cuba, do you not? Although they are learning, many of the communist countries, after many decades, have learned what? It doesn't work. Once Mao Zedong died, the Chinese government began to go into capitalism. They found out that does work. And the United States went into socialism. They still haven't figured out that it doesn't work. Mikhail Gorbachev figured out communism is not working. When Khrushchev came over here to the United Nations and said to the American people on our own soil, we will bury you, that was about as ignorant of a statement as anybody could ever make. Mikhail Gorbachev realized that and realized, too, that there had to be a change and open it up to capitalism, ownership of land, property, all of these type of things. You know, as I said, remember the property, the land. You know, it's very interesting when you take a look at land. Socialist governments and communist governments take over the land. You just live on it. You rent from the government, something like that. Without turning to it, let me just refer you to Joshua chapters 13 through 19. In those six or seven chapters is the distribution of the land to the tribes and by the families and to stay there and not to leave. That is, stay in the family, stay in the tribe. One of the things that you find that God gives is the land because there is wealth in the land. And that's how an individual is able to make a living, by ownership of land and production on the land that comes from it. You find, too, that Joshua, I won't turn to it, but I'll just show you his closing remarks, Joshua 23 and verses 6 through 8. I've given you this land as long as you continue to keep the commandments of God and all of his ordinances, which includes what? These principles and these laws of economics. You don't charge interest to your brother, to your fellow citizen. You don't tax them heavily. You don't create a situation of inflation by changing the balances of the scales and so forth, and on and on. And you don't go into some a economic philosophy, which frankly is a philosophy that is of the God of this world, to enslave people. Winston Churchill said of communism, which is socialism, that one thing is for certain, for those who are involved in it, they will all be equally poor. There will never be any equal wealth. It will always be equally poor. Well, we find that here we have people that have taken up on this in our country, and that's how we are ruled today. Now, the majority of the people, not knowing what it's going to lead to, think that socialism is great because it seems to be so much fairer. And after all, I'm going to get something. It's going to give me something. And it's got to be good because it's really helping me out. Is it really? On the short term, yes. But on the long term, as Hosea 4, verse 6 says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, not understanding some of these things, and thinking, well, boy, this is going to really help me. It's going to take care of me, and I'm in great shape. Now, Churchill was right, and once you look at it and study it, you'll begin to see that that is correct, too, that that statement by Churchill was right. Now, I spoke in a church one time in another country, and after the sermon, the pastor came up and talked to me and said he appreciated a comment I made having to do with Matthew chapter 25. Now, I was not speaking on economics at the time, but I did, for some reason, reference Matthew 25, and I'm going to turn to it because Jesus Christ talks about some of these things, and because afterwards he said, I'm glad, you know, I have members here who believe that socialism is what will be in the kingdom of God. This happened to be at the Feast of Tabernacles. And so I'm glad you talked about or brought that up. That was not, I didn't even intend to talk about it. I just, for something, brought it to my mind to say it at the time. But here in Matthew chapter 25, let's see what Christ had to say in these parables. This is the parable of the talents beginning in verse 14. For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, and to each according to his own ability. And immediately he went on a journey. Did you notice something about that? He did not distribute equally, did he? He did not distribute equally. All right. Since you're familiar with the story, let's go down to the conclusion here, to the guy who got the one. In verse 24, then he who had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. Now, I was afraid, and I went and I hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours. But his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. That's interesting. Therefore take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10. That's not fair. That's not fair, is it? A lot of people would say. Well, why? Well, he went on, for to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. Didn't it seem like he should have taken the one and given it to the guy with 5? Because, you know, the one with 10, because he produced the most. He produced more. Look at Luke chapter 19. Luke 19. This is interesting. The same. It's just a different circumstance. Here it has to do with the minas, or the pounds, if you, depending on which King James Bible you're using. But in Luke 19, and let's take a look at verse 23, getting again to the conclusion of the matter. Why then did you, Jesus asking him, or the king asking, not put my money in the bank that at my coming I might have collected it with interest? He said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to him who has 10 minas. But they said to him, Master, he has 10 minas. For I say to you that to everyone who has will be given, and from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. Now what you see in both of those examples and parables is that there is no equal distribution to begin with. There is no equal distribution at the end, when he comes to collect or to assess what has gone on in the time that he had been away. No, you will find the principles both in the Old Testament as well as what we see for the kingdom of God, and what Jesus even pointed out in some of the parables, that there are things of where people have talents who can produce and can do much more, and yes, they should obviously be rewarded for their work and what they do. The principles of socialism, maybe some people thought that because of the times they lived in, that that was the only thing that would give any respite to human beings and what they were going through, but that is not really God's way at all. And we don't see that anywhere in the Old Testament. We don't see that in the church in the New, and it's not going to be that way in the kingdom of God. Again, who is really behind such a system as that? When you understand what it will eventually lead to if you have it completely take over, and that is, not only does it lead to borrowing, obviously, because you run out of money. And those who have practiced communism, socialism, they have gone broke. Russia, China, Cuba, all the Cuban state workers being laid off this year. Told last year they would be laid off. Why? Because it's so wonderful. What do? We have depended on the state to take care of us. And now the state can't take care of us anymore. It is. It takes a long time for people to adjust and to learn once again to use their talents so that they can be able to grow. Well, what will this worsening U.S. economic situation and world economic crisis, what's it eventually going to lead to? Let me just to save you a little time. In Jeremiah chapter 30 and verse 7, it will lead, among other things, to the time of Jacob's trouble. This is one of the major things that is going to lead us into that situation, because why? Well, Deuteronomy 28, if you turn away from me, and the majority of this nation really has, well, then this is what's going to happen. And so a time, certainly, of Jacob's trouble will come on this country. And how soon will it be? Well, I can't predict, and I'm not here to do a lot of predicting. But our godless economic philosophy that we can spend our way out of poverty by redistributing the wealth and overtaxing the private sector will in the end fail. And it is failing now. 2 + 2 = 4. The principles behind this debt ceiling thing, even I think a child can understand. That if you've spent more than you're taking in, you can't raise your debt ceiling so you can spend more. You have to cut back now, not a decade from now, but now, your expenses. You can't be raising taxes on businesses and they call them the rich, on the businesses and corporations. Why? Well, you know, if we do that, they're going to be able to expand business and hire more people. Now, that's ludicrous and ridiculous. You have got to make it so that business can't expand. Poor people do not hire poor people and give them jobs. You have to allow it. Is everything perfect? No, it's not perfect. But the principle there, you cannot follow the principle of social. Well, we just raise taxes and take from those rich people more money. My mother used to call. She kind of fell for that kind of talk back in her day and age. Why those rich devils up there? Like as though they're just hoarding all this money and putting it away. They're investing and reinvesting. And you need people to be able to produce, to invest and reinvest so that if you're out of work, you might be able to get hired and get a job. Otherwise, you're going to stay poor and unemployed. Now, you destroy the private sector, it's going to destroy everybody else too. Because the government cannot provide unless there's something they can take in. And that has to come from the private sector. Get the government off the people's back, as Reagan said, and how true that was. In Revelation chapter 6, time of the end, and here we have the four horsemen. Let's take a look at a couple of these scriptures to end on. Where are we heading to? In Revelation 6, and verse 5 and 6, when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Now, there's a lot of symbolism, of course, in these four horses and of the seals here that are being opened by Jesus Christ. But one thing we can see here in verse 6 is inflation. And what's causing this inflation? Because the denarius here represents a day's wages. That's what a denarius was. And a day's wages to buy a quart of wheat. That's inflation. Why is there inflation? Well, I would looking at the 20th century and into the 21st century, I would say that socialism being practiced by governments where they are spending more than they are taking in because they are controlling more and they are expanding over their societies. And it is creating a situation of inflation. I mean, it's not that hard to figure out. What we see, we should ask the question, will history repeat itself? I personally think that it will, and we'll see in time if that is the case. Following the First World War, during the 20s and into the 30s, the economic depression of those period of time, especially in Europe and in Germany, the people looked to Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. Here was a man who spoke with confidence, and he will solve my problems. They didn't understand anything about National Socialism. By the way, that's what the Nazi Party was, National Socialists. So they went along with it. And, things are going to be turned around. And at first, they seemed like they were. But it also seems, too, that historically, a statement that is historically consistent is the one that says, if we do not learn the lessons of history, then we're bound to repeat them. Is this going to be repeated? Well, time will tell. It's been 100 years, and 2014 will be 100 years since the beginning of World War I. And 2015 will be 70 years since the end of World War II. We had some 20 years between the First and Second World War. Looks like we have somewhere now maybe upwards of 70 years, whatever it's going to be, because World War III will be the Great Tribulation when it comes. It was by economic depression and world depression that brought about the rise of really the sixth head of the revival of the Roman Empire. And we have had this period of time since World War II to be able to worship God in freedom. We haven't had the problems. We've had our wars and so forth, but we've been able, God has kept us out of them as a church and as brethren. We've had relatively good times and peace as a church and as a work. But a time is coming when that peace is going to come to an end, and we should be aware. And this may be a foretaste of that by the fact that our economy and the world's economy is in such grave trouble. How long will it take? I don't know. But this is something that was forecasted in the pages of Plain Truth magazine when I came into the church 45 years ago. It was way ahead of its time. Notice in Revelation 13, let's over here quickly, Revelation 13. This is talking about the beast rising out of the sea at the beginning. But I want to drop down to verse 16 and 17. He causes this beast all, and this is the second beast there beginning in verse 11. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. He can't buy or sell. Very interesting. A mark on the forehead. Again, it is symbolic. The hands represent one's actions. The forehead represents the beliefs that are in that head, do they not? If you look at chapter 14 and verse 11 and 12, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. The smoke does, but they don't. And they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. When you put the verses together from chapter 13 and chapter 14, those who have the mark of the beast, if you want to buy and sell, that's economy, isn't it? That's economics, buying and selling, getting involved. What commandment in verse 12 would have to do with being able to buy and sell? Well, as Mr. Armstrong used to say, the only one I can think of would have to do with the Sabbath. That one day that will be really what the mark of the beast will turn out to be. What is the mark or the sign of God in the Bible? Well, in Exodus 31, verse 13 and 17, it's the Sabbath. It's the sign between me and my people, both physically Israel and certainly his people in the New Testament, the church today as well. It is the sign. It is a mark, a sign. But here is a mark that has to do with buying and selling. Now, I know a lot of church groups think that there's going to be some computer chip put in your forehead or some other kind of physical thing done. This is symbolic of something else. And it has to do with keeping the commandments of God. And the only one that has to do with the keeping and commandments of God in economics would have to be the Sabbath. And that's why we've always felt that this mark is talking in the future about the Sabbath. Obviously, there appears to be a time coming when there will be worldwide economic either depression or recession or something causing a tremendous collapse. And rising up out of that will be the final resurrection of the Roman Empire, the seventh head. Along with it, it appears that it's going to be very difficult for people to be able to buy and sell, or that is, to be able to work and keep the Sabbath. We're finding that out even more and more today. It's always been a problem, but it's very difficult for people when you have high unemployment and trying to find work. Well, I can take you if you'll work Friday night or Saturday. It really makes it hard, doesn't it? Especially when people maybe have been out of work a long time. Is some of that already in play? We should consider that. When this system rises, as you look at chapter 18 of Revelation, is it going to be a poor system? Apparently, it's going to rise out of the rubble of economic disaster and become very powerful economically. Revelation 18 and verse 11 and 12, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones, pearls, fine linen and pearl, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and on it goes, indicating that there must have been a great economy here when Babylon the Great falls. When it falls. And indeed, maybe it will rise. But it would be very, very difficult for those who are left in this world during that period of time. Well, brethren, we can see, I think, if we look at things carefully here, that our nation and most of the world is moving into a very serious economic crisis that has been building up for many years. So what should we be doing about it? Well, let's go back here to Luke chapter 21. Luke 21. You cannot physically do anything. Your vote means nothing. We don't want to get involved in the politics of this world anyhow. But there isn't anything physically we're going to do about it at this time. We will have the pleasure, under the direction of Jesus Christ and the world tomorrow, to set things straight. And that will be really exhilarating to do. But here in Luke 21:36, we've seen this before. Watch, therefore, and we should be watching these things. What does this mean? What's it leading to? And pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Well, brethren, let's be watching these ongoing events and pray always that we may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will eventually lead the world into great tribulation.